We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and an estimated 5 million Americans now have it. The Orange Sullivan Walk to End Alzheimer's is coming up, and we'll speak to the chair of the walk, Kathy Wills, about her very personal reason for being involved. The Keshecton Pump House, just what's inside that historical landmark with architectural details and a view, and how did it come about? Contributor Jesse Spisato speaks to the team behind it. Rural shorts, short films at the Big Eddy Film Festival, all shot here in the region, we'll get a preview. And Lady Capulet, a classical prequel following the journey of Juliet's mother, Rose, we'll get an interview with the lead actress. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. The House Budget Committee meets this afternoon to mark up what it's calling a human infrastructure bill. It's facing GOP opposition as well as infighting among Democrats. Then there's the bipartisan trillion-dollar infrastructure bill approved by the Senate. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports President Biden has been working with lawmakers to try to bridge the divide.
Speaking at the White House on Friday, President Biden said he encouraged House Democrats to find common ground on a both bipartisan infrastructure bill and the larger spending and tax package that would advance his domestic agenda.
One of the things that I think is important for, and I'm trying to get people to focus on, is what is it you like? What do you think we should, don't forget a number. What do you think we should be doing?
Moderate Democrats say they're ready to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but the party's more left-leaning progressives are insisting that the larger spending plan be considered first or at least at the same time. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The Treasury Department has cleared the way for aid groups to deliver humanitarian supplies to Afghanistan without fear of violating U.S. sanctions. NPR's Scott Horsley reports help is desperately needed in the country as the Afghan winter approaches.
The Treasury Department issued two general licenses allowing aid groups to deliver food, medicine, and other humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan, despite longstanding economic sanctions that prohibit doing business with the Taliban. Treasury officials say those sanctions remain in effect, but they should not limit the flow of badly needed assistance to the people of Afghanistan. Aid groups welcome the move, noting that even before the Taliban's takeover last month, Afghanistan was desperate for humanitarian help. Besides the political upheaval, much of the country is drought-stricken, and more than half the children under five are at risk of severe malnutrition. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Somalia say a vehicle exploded outside the presidential palace in the capital of Mogadishu today. The Islamist movement Al-Shabaab is claiming responsibility for the attack. The BBC's Mary Harper reports at least seven people have been reported killed in the explosion.
Eyewitnesses said seven cars and three auto rickshaws were destroyed. Car bombings are not as common in Mogadishu as they used to be because they're finding it harder to get through checkpoints. But the violence continues. Al-Shabaab is sending in more suicide bombers on foot who've blown themselves up in tea shops and ice cream parlours. Critics say Somali politicians are so preoccupied with rowing about a much-delayed election process that they've taken their eyes off the country's urgent security and humanitarian challenges.
That's the BBC's Mary Harper reporting, and you're listening to NPR News. Leaders from Haiti, India, and Ethiopia are addressing the UN General Assembly in New York today. The Haitian Prime Minister is speaking on behalf of a country in turmoil following a presidential assassination, an earthquake, and the U.S. expulsion of thousands of Haitian migrants. Ethiopia faces pressure over its role in reported starvation deaths in the Tigray region, and India's Prime Minister is expected to respond to scathing rhetoric from Pakistan. Regulators in Texas say recent earthquakes in the state are related to fracking. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh has more.
The fracking boom in the West Texas Permian Basin has coincided with a significant increase in earthquakes above 3.5 on the Richter scale, which were exceptionally rare in that area. The Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates oil and gas, not railroads, is requesting that companies reduce the amount of fracking byproducts they inject into the ground. The request is an about-face for the agency, which has previously pushed back on studies that found a connection between fracking activities and earthquakes. The agency says it won't grant new injection permits until further notice, and that it expects the requested restrictions to stay in place for a year. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in San Antonio.
An erupting volcano on the Spanish island of La Palma has destroyed hundreds of homes and sent thousands of people fleeing. Lava has been flowing into villages and ash has been shooting skyward since a crack opened up last weekend. Experts say the volcano could remain active for months to come. I'm Amy Held in Washington. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Samir Naguib, whose bequest helps ensure access for all to quality public radio reporting and stories that encourage lifelong learning, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Alzheimer's Association says Alzheimer's disease is the only one of the top 10 causes of death in the U.S. without any methods for preventing, curing, or slowing it down. Research into a vaccine continues, but so far there are no sure ways to prevent Alzheimer's disease from developing. However, medications can help relieve some symptoms. Finding a cure and a commitment to ending the disease is why many participate in nationwide walks to end Alzheimer's. The Orange Sullivan Walk is coming up October 9th, and we spoke to the chair of the walk, Kathy Wills, about how it is motivating her and how the death of both of her parents caused her to become involved. So as the chair for the walk, what is your initiative this year to get folks motivated?
Well, we're constantly providing programs and services and as well as research to find an end to this disease. Our function for the walk and hoping that people join us at the walk is an opportunity to talk to other people that have been caregivers, that have been involved in the organization, that have the stories to tell, you know. Telling stories is very, very important. People need to know that they're not alone. They need to know that there's a lot of services out there that can help them through caring for someone with Alzheimer's. And the programs and services are endless. Whatever someone needs, they will find a way to help them. Mm-hmm. And we need to let people know that the organization is out there doing that.
So the walk to end Alzheimer's is the world's largest event to fight Alzheimer's. Can you tell folks who are listening where things are in terms of research and you know the eventual hopeful end to Alzheimer's or some sort of other treatment?
There's a lot of research going on. There was recently a medication that was shown to help improve cognitive and help people be self-sufficient longer. I mean, our ultimate goal is to find a cure for it. In the meantime, just being able for someone to maintain their daily activities, daily routines is just vitally important. Research is ongoing. There have been medications in the past that have helped, but Alzheimer's it comes from so many different directions. You know, there's looking at activity levels, exercise levels. There's looking at nutritional levels. It comes from so many different lifestyles that research can look into the medical portion of it, and they now know that there's buildup of plaque in the brain that causes it. And it's just something we need a lot of people to sign up for clinical trials. And we need, you know, just people to participate. That's going to be critical in finding a cure for it. And I strongly believe that we will get there.
And you mentioned that there was recently in June, the Food and Drug Administration approved the drug Aduhelm. It's not a cure, but believed to be a way to extend the quality of life for those in the early stages of Alzheimer's. Was that a result of folks involved with clinical trials, to your knowledge?
I believe it was, yes. Even the medications that were out earlier, I know my mom took something called Aricept and Namenda, and I believe that it delayed the progress. Because my father also had Alzheimer's, but both my parents did. Yeah. And my father's was more progressed, and unfortunately for him, the Aricept caused him a very bad reaction, and we couldn't use it. But my mom did, and I firmly believe that it slowed the progression for her. Because Dad had lost the ability to speak, whereas Mom never did. So, I have to believe that was what helped delay her progression.
You had mentioned earlier in our conversation about people telling their stories. So that's your story. Both of your parents had Alzheimer's.
Yes, yes. I took care of them for a combination of 15 years. My father's was earlier on than my mother's was. But it was a 15-year battle for each of them. My dad died in 2011 at 94, and my mom died in 2017 at 95. But the last 7 years of each of their lives was very difficult for them. The memory loss, the constant, repeating stories, the not knowing you, one day you would go and they knew who you were, another day they wouldn't, and it's heartbreaking to watch someone go through that. It appeared that they always knew each other, but they didn't really communicate anymore because my father had lost the inability to speak, and I kept them together. They were both in the same assisted living for the first 3 years, and then as my dad's progressed to human into nursing home care, they were somewhat separated, but they could still see each other fairly regularly. But, I think it's important that people share their stories and talk about how this disease has affected everything in their family life. I mean, my heartbreak was that my parents were married 69 years when my father died. And they spent their entire life building memories, and the memories were gone. The last 15 years of their life, they just didn't have memories to share, and that was very sad.
Hmm. Is that what motivated you to become more involved with the Alzheimer's organization in the Hudson Valley?
Absolutely, because when my parents both started showing signs of dementia and I had no idea where to begin, and I called the toll-free number, and I spoke to someone who could not have been more terrific. They were understanding. They were guiding me through every step of the way of where to begin, what I needed to do, how I needed to start the process of helping my parents, and I would not have known what to do without them. And the support services, the programs, just the information. I mean, I would go online, and read everything that I could possibly learn about Alzheimer's and try to be a step ahead of what may or may not happen next. Because Alzheimer's doesn't progress the same for everyone. I was very fortunate in the fact that I knew the information, I knew the questions to ask, and that's all because of the Alzheimer's Association. And now I'm paying it forward. I want to make sure that other people out there know that this organization exists, and they will help you any way they possibly can to make it as easy for you to get through the whole process of this disease.
Going through that with both of your parents, I know, obviously heartbreaking, as you've mentioned. Would you expect that you would be the chair of the largest fundraising activity to help end this disease at that time, as when you made that phone call?
No, I never expected this to happen, but I am grateful for the opportunity that I can pay it forward and I can help somebody else in any way that I can. I mean, I go to a lot of events and I meet people, and even just in general, you use the word Alzheimer's, and there's always someone who knows someone or has been through it. And I've had a lot of people say to me, I wish I knew the organization existed, because when I needed help 10 years ago or I needed help 5 years ago, you know, it might have made it easier for me. And that's what motivates me to make sure that everybody out there knows that all you need to do is pick up that phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there will be someone to help you. The Hudson Valley chapter is the greatest people that I have ever worked with. And they do everything, even above and beyond what any requirement may be for anybody. If they don't know exactly what to do, they will find out how and find somebody to help you one way or the other.
The chapter covers multiple counties in the region, and there are multiple walks, therefore. Westchester County has their walk on October 3rd. The Orange County Sullivan Walk is October 9th, and then there are others through Dutchess, Ulster, Putnam, and Rockland throughout the month. How can folks get involved in any of these walks? What can they do?
They can always go online to the alz.org/Hudson Valley, or they can just Google Walk to End Alzheimer's, and then it'll break it down into local chapters.
Okay, and these are in-person walks this fall?
They are in-person walks this fall, but we are offering kind of a hybrid. If people aren't comfortable coming in person, we're going to do a live stream where they can download an app and they can join. They can watch the opening ceremony. They can join the walk anywhere they want. There's going to be a part of an app where they can grab a Promise Garden flower and attach it to their page. So they can participate however they feel comfortable. We are going to follow the full CDC guidelines. We're going to ask people if they have COVID, if they tested positive, if they've been exposed, to please not expose anybody else. But we'll have masks, and we'll have hand sanitizer, and we're going to social distance, and we're going to completely follow all the guidelines, and we ask everybody to please join us in following those guidelines. In person is optional, but we certainly would love people to join us in person if they can and if they feel comfortable doing that.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you about the flowers that are symbolic of the walks. Can you tell folks about why flowers are an important symbol for these walks?
The flowers have become a tradition. They're different colors depending on why you're involved with the Alzheimer's Association. The blue ones are for people that are living with Alzheimer's, that have been diagnosed and are living with it. The purple ones are carried by people that have lost someone to Alzheimer's. When I first started doing the walk, I had a blue one because they were both living with Alzheimer's. I had to use two blue ones. And then the following year, I had one blue and one purple. And then the year after that, I had two purple ones. But they let us know why you're walking with us. The yellow ones are for caregivers, anyone that is caring for an individual or someone that they love that is living with Alzheimer's. The orange ones are for people that support the cause, whether they've been affected by it, haven't been affected by it, know someone, but they're there to support us. At the end of the walk, we plant them all in the flower garden, and it's a beautiful array of colors. And if it's a windy day, they spin their windmill kind of pinwheel type flowers, and it's very symbolic. It's also very emotional.
Yeah.
We write names on the flowers, and it's an emotional portion.
Keeping those memories alive.
Exactly, and it's healing in a sense. You know, I know that when my flowers spin, it's because my parents are watching.
I'm sure they are, and I'm sure they're very proud of you for what you're doing. We've been talking to Kathy Willis. She's the chair of the Walk to End Alzheimer's. Those walks are coming up throughout the Hudson Valley in October. You can find out more information and registration information at alz.org/Hudson Valley. And the 24/7 helpline is 800-272-3900. Kathy, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Tim, thank you so much, and thank you to everyone out there that supports our cause. This disease is unforgiving in so many ways. It just takes so much from a person. And if you feel that you might want to ask a few questions, or maybe, you know, have a little advance notice of what may be happening to someone, don't hesitate to call the toll-free number. They will be there to help you. And we hope to see you on the 9th.
Again, the number is 800-272-3900. Kathy, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. You stay well.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, inside the Coshecton Pump House.
Donna Fellenberg here, and this Saturday on Catskill Character, my guest will be the magical Sasha Graham, and we're going to be talking about the experience of sending your only child off to college. How do you deal with all the emotion? Sasha will share her experience, and although she's magical, she's got some very down-to-earth thoughts on the subject. That's Catskill Character, Saturday at 11:30 on WJFF.
The Radio Catskill Community Awards, honoring our healthcare heroes, September 30th, for putting the well-being of others above all else, including Julie Pizzal, the Kingfisher Project.
Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country.
Join us at Calicoon Hills, September 30th. Ticket information at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The brick walls at State Route 97 and County Highway 116 in Sullivan County are the remains of an old oil pump station known locally as the Pump House. In total, in the past, there were 11 stations, stretching between Olean, New York and Bayonne, New Jersey. The architectural remains once housed Brooklyn-made Worthington pumps and Klein steam engines pumping crude oil. At peak operation, the pipeline pumped 40,000 barrels a day, a total of 315 miles to Bayonne. The Coshecton Pump House survived 90 years of nature, local scavenging, and even an ill-fated attempt to be destroyed by dynamite. And now it's been made into an immersive space for events, exhibits, food, and more. WJFF's Jesse Sposato spoke to Dave Lieber, co-founder of the Pump House, about how the venue came together.
So I want to start from the beginning. You've probably answered this question many times already, but for those who don't know, the Coshecton Pump House is an outdoor gathering space and, you know, low-key eatery built in a former oil pump station. When and how did you first get the idea to resurrect the building?
I've been asked this question a million times. Last year, in response to when COVID came and the shutdowns came, you know, for work, it was springtime, and you know, I lost my job in entertainment, and me and my partner Jin were getting kind of stir crazy. Decided to try like a food pop up. Mm-hmm. Because we both kind of missed eating in the city, missed like good Chinese street food stuff that we get in Flushing. And we decided just like try it out. We're like, why not? Well, maybe we can just get like a little mobile food vending permit and we'll just was try, you know, selling Chinese shawco, like meat on a stick. And so we wound up doing Dave's Backyard Skewer, which was our little pop-up food stand last summer mm-hmm. in our backyard. And, you know, it was kind of like a smash hit. Everybody loved to come hang out in the backyard. It was super COVID-friendly. Food was pretty good, too, I will say so myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people came into the backyard, and then peeking through the trees across the creek was, you know, the old pump house. And everyone kept asking, like, what's that building over there? What is that old thing? And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's just some old brick building, some ruin or whatever. And it just kept coming up, like, I would say at least once a day someone would mention it. And then, I think one day a friend of mine came down and mentioned, like, it's a really cool building. You should try doing something with it. And I think I had just heard of it so many times. Like, well, fine. All right. Well, we'll do something with it. and it was like money where my mouth is, like foot in mouth, totally. Like literally the next day, it turned out the current owner of the property had stopped by, or I forget exactly how it wound up, but someone had hooked us up and an offer was made and some money was spent and we were the new proud owners of the pump house. Wow. And yeah, you know, like a crumbling brick building with a bunch of trees growing inside with no access, like locks between the, you know, the freeway and the railroad tracks. Like, great, now what? Yeah, and so I feel like exploring it with a couple friends and, you know, talking with Jen and my friend Martin and a bunch of people, kind of, we all just kind of brainstormed and we all had different ideas of what it could be. We kind of landed on, well, just fill it in and, you know, try to do something inside of it. And then we're like, well, food and drinks would be kind of cool. And, you know, I don't know, 8 months later, 8 months later, and like a ton of work and a ton of gravel and a ton of, you know, blood and sweat and crying and everything else, we have a bump house as you see it today.
Awesome. That's a great origin story.
Yeah, no, it was like more of, more than anything, it was, I feel like it was almost a dare that you won't, like, oh yeah.
Right.
But then at the same time, too, the building was like really amazing when you went into it. I don't know, did you ever see the place before?
Well, I just saw like photos on your website, which it's pretty cool because my friend was asking the other day, like, oh, did it ever have a roof? And I was like, no, it did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, yeah, it certainly did. In fact, there was two other buildings situated on the other side of the creek. You know, the whole complex was once, you know, in the 1880s to the 1920s. It was the thriving economic and industrial area of Coshocton. Like, that was... It was a booming area back in the day. So there's a sawmill on the other side of the railroad tracks, okay. And a popular watering hole, and yeah, that was quite the spot back in the day.
That's wild. And this is a question that I was trying to figure out the other day with friends. Was the pump station actually like in use, or did it just get built and then was never in use?
No, it was, in fact, all right, so the history as I know it is that in 1881, Rockefeller wanted the oil that was in Olean, New York, mm-hmm. You know, Marcellus shale oil, you know, it's kind of the world that the fracking's done, but all that Marcellus shale had like a big oil reserve, in fact, the biggest oil reserve in the world, I think it was the biggest discovery of oil in the world at the time, and it was, some of it was being pumped from Eastern New York to Ohio. So Rockefeller's like, well, I want to send it to New York because he's got the port town. So he built a series of pump houses, 300 miles from Olean to Bayonne, New Jersey. Every, I say 30, but I think it was like 40 miles or 50 miles, there was one of these steam-powered pump houses. It was a steam house, then another building was the pump house, and then there's a communications building. And then from 1881 to 1920, they pumped about 400,000 barrels of crude oil 24 hours a day through four pipelines to Bayonne, New Jersey. And, yeah, it was quite productive.
Wow.
Considering back in the day, yeah, no, I think at peak production, they said it was a barrel of oil, was a pound of coal for a barrel of oil, which was kind of a staggering statistic. So there was a ton of, you know, probably very, you know, sooty and smoky over there back in the day, but
yeah, definitely. You know. That's super interesting, and also good job on like having your history down.
Thanks.
You had mentioned the events a little bit in the beginning, like you do events, yep, and performances. Can you, yep, tell me a little bit more about like what kinds of events you've done and what you're hoping to do in the future?
And the plan was to create, you know, after we created the space and we got like, all right, great, beer garden, check, food, check. Then we're like, well, it'd be great to have some really good programming. And so in the past, like in over the course of the summer, as we kind of soft opened, you know, we got some different musical acts, you know, the whole spectrum of music from, you know, we'd love to have country music, you know, some that, that baby boomer, Bethel Woods crowd style music, to more of, even like we had a, we had a wonderful, old time music group. It was just a guitar, a banjo, upright bass and a fiddle. And they came and played kind of like acoustic and it was just amazing. And then, you know, to broaden the spectrum, some local dance, performing artists came and played, or performed rather, and just used the space as a, you know, stage, and we're able to do, a couple of shows there. And that was a lot of fun. And we're hoping to do, you know, host art exhibits or, you know, comedy or parties. We're trying to get the whole gamut, kind of create like a little spot where, you know, we can just bring a little culture into the area without a whole lot of reservations or constraints, just anything goes.
I love that. I feel like that's so needed right now here.
Yeah. Open air, like entertainment, not like, you know, big box entertainment, like, you know, one of our, you know, our larger competitors for music. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, just something small and just like a cozy little venue. That's all.
Well, you mentioned that you had worked in entertainment. So I was wondering like what past experiences you've had that kind of made you feel equipped or in psyched to like take on a project.
Yeah, well, 20 years of entertainment. You know, I started out in theater and then moved to television and film in New York when I moved out here 20 years ago. And so, as a, you know, I got a background in carpentry and set dressing and props and scenic painting and set design. So all those things kind of worked out good for working with something that wasn't necessarily like a building renovation, and then treating it as like a backdrop or like a preservation. So I kind of was able to, you know, I knew how to get my hands dirty and get up on a lift and fix stuff, but I also knew how to present it to people who didn't quite understand what I was up to. So I was able to draft and do a little previs and create nice packages and, you know, explain to everyone what I intended to do with a building without a roof, which was kind of complicated. But yeah, my background and in the film industry, I definitely helped.
Yeah, that seems like the perfect like background to have for this kind of project.
Yeah, totally.
And this is kind of a dumb question, but like, how long are you guys planning to stay open for? Like, how long into the season are you going to like do all year round? Or
yeah, well, we're thinking like we're going to be a hard 3-season spot. Yeah. You know, until the snow flies, we went all in on our gravel parking lot, and if, you know, the snow comes, like, we're afraid to plow it, because that would destroy everything we worked for. That said, like, we fully plan to, like, you know, switch the menu over, start working out some hot foods, like, get some soups and things that you can bundle up with, and just kind of lean into the fall. It's just, you know, outdoor dining's a thing now. I think if you bundle up and you have the right attitude, maybe a couple of drinks in you or, you know, some hot soup, you can hang out for a little bit and find a creative way to heat it up. And then, you know, who knows? Like, if we can get into the winter, it'd be interesting to see. Like, there's all the advertising bucks are spent on bringing people up in the spring, summer, and fall to the, you know, the area. And everybody knows, it's kind of like a no-brainer, it's beautiful up here.
Yeah.
But no one ever pushes, like, the wintertime, come up for the wintertime, come see, like, you know, in January, come check us out in February. Yeah. So, you know, maybe there's a way to, to create more of a market for, you know, wintertime stuff up here. And if that means, you know, sitting in an old, snowy, you know, pump house with an ice bar, maybe that's a thing, who knows?
It sounds fun. I'd be there.
Cool.
So I just wanted to ask you one thing that I'd read on your website. There's a mention of the pump house surviving an ill-fated attempt to be destroyed by dynamite.
Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Totally possibly true folklore that maybe might have happened. So legend has it that in the 30s they came to take down, and we actually have a photographic record of them, a triptych exists, of the smokestack being demoed because they were worried that it would go or it would fall into the railroad tracks. And then they also, in that same operation, taken out the old steam house and buried it. But when they came over to the pump house, when they gave it a blast, this is what I've been told by really, really good sources at the local historical society, right? They heard that they tried hitting it with dynamite, but because it was set in concrete and not lime, that it just blew out the windows and nothing happened, and nobody wanted to deal with taking it down and left it to rot away.
Wow. Wild.
I know. Totally, possibly, not likely true, but sure sounds good, doesn't it?
It does. And my just very last question, I usually ask people, why is Sullivan County like an awesome place to be doing something like this?
Sullivan County is awesome because the corridor, just that Route 97 is such an awesome drive.
Yeah.
There's such awesome scenery. It's just a cool, there's a ton of cool people. You'd be surprised at the variety of, you know, there's so many different people, so many different backgrounds, artists and, you know, like craftsmen and old farmers and you know, Broadway dropouts and, you know, ex-New York City Pats that kind of come up here. And it's just a great place to, you know, create a space to bring people together. And we've met just a ton of really cool people. And we all get together and celebrate, you know, the beautiful outdoors and come together at the pump house. So I don't know, it's just, it's a good place because of that. Does that make any sense?
Perfect. I love it. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to add that I didn't ask you about?
That's pretty much it. Like, we're really, you know, one thing I would love to add is I'd like to, if I can, just, you know, extend to everyone who's come and supported us and people who come back and tell their friends, like, how grateful we are. Like, this is beyond anything we ever expected. No way did we ever think that people would, like, respond to it like they did. And, yeah, we're just, like, humbled, and like, I'm embarrassed. We can't believe, like, the turnout.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's so heartwarming.
So we're so proud of it, and we're just so into, like, all the different, like, walks of life that are coming in, and people hanging out, and all the dogs we get to see. Like, it's just become, like, a real joy for us.
Thanks so much for chatting. This was great.
All right. Well, thanks for having me to talk to.
Totally.
All right, later, bye.
Bye.
WJFF's Jesse Spisato, and you can find more information, including historical photos of the original pump house, at KeshectonPumpHouse.com. This is Radio Chatskill. When we come back, a preview of short films at the Big Eddy Film Festival, all of them filmed locally.
The Radio Catskill Community Awards, honoring our healthcare heroes for making a difference, including Sullivan 180.
Because Sullivan County consistently ranks at the bottom of the health rankings, we're currently 60 out of 62, we're engaging children and youth so that they can play a role in helping to turn around the county's health rankings.
Join us at Calicoon Hills September 30th. Ticket information at wjffradio.org.
So often people want to talk about the Underground Railroad, but the face of slavery, the mechanism of slavery, the brutality of slavery, the inhumanity of slavery, and the hypocrisy of slavery is not part of that conversation as it should be.
Who is Austin Stewart? What was his journey from enslavement to freedom? And why should we care?
Saturday at noon on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's the 10th anniversary of the Big Eddy Film Festival, and it will feature 25 independent films and visiting filmmakers starting September 30th through October 3rd at Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. It includes the premiere of several new films in their program of rural shorts on Saturday, October 2nd. This collection of seven different short films showcases this area's filmmakers at work, from documentary to music video, television segments to dramatic films. Every piece in the program was shot in the Sullivan County Catskills and one in neighboring Orange County over the past 18 months. I spoke to three of those filmmakers about their shorts, Matt Sukar, Lori Goodsda, and Kelly Adams. Matt, we'll start with you and Pearl and Duke. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your short?
Sure. Carolyn Duke is a film that we shot in Narrowsburg and Eldred. And it stars two or three very close friends of mine, Emily Mead, Duke Nicholson, and Philip Ettinger. And it's about a complicated relationship between Pearl and Duke and their isolated life together.
And you shot this over the course of how long in Narrowsburg area?
We shot it over, I think, 2 days, 2.5 days.
And is that a typical time for a short? I'm not familiar with what the production would be like on a short, or actually even a feature film. But what is that like for you when shooting a short?
Yeah, I mean, it was tough because our actors had busy schedules, so we kind of just had to. We had 2.5 days, so we just had to shoot it over a weekend, and that was the parameters allowed. It would have been. It's always nice to have more time, but I also like to work under the pressure.
Thrives on the pressure.
But yeah, I think so.
Lori, yours is the tale of the Big Eddie, and yeah. It's a very interesting premise. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. So I guess it was 2019 that a group of us got together to create a comedy show that we performed in Narrowsburg in the Emerald Ballroom, and with sold out shows. We had to bring it back. It was so popular. And in this show, Heidi Mollenhauer wrote these amazing songs, four or five original pieces of music for the show. One of them was Tale of the Big Eddie. And it's just this charming story about the myth of an old fisherman, the legend of a giant eel, and the relationship between the two. So when the pandemic hit and we were trying to gear up for another show, we figured, well, why don't we videotape? So we met, we were able to, distance until we all got tested, and, we took, precautions as we shot. But we were able to shoot most of it in 2 days, some of the backup footage, the B-roll, another day or two, and then we had to go back and shoot again. So we probably had a good 4 or 5 days shooting because of weather and seasons. But it's a fun, whimsical tale of a giant eel that lives in the Narrows.
And it's a mythical river serpent, Eddie. Is it real? Is it played by someone, or is Eddie an animal, or how did you pull that off?
Eddie is a big eel. So we have a modern day fisherman telling us about the old eel fisherman to a group of children who happen to be, sitting by the river discussing the myth and the legend of this eel.
And a perfect segue into children or younger film participants. Kelly, you're the faculty supervisor for the Homestead School who helped with the world premiere of Haywire. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Haywire is a completely student-written and filmed, acted in. We did have somebody who helped us with the editing, but otherwise it's completely student-made. And Haywire is a story about a girl who makes a wish that her entire life was different. And when her wish is granted, she learns the lesson of, be careful what you wish for. We had to use just the equipment that was there. We knew that it had to be, the actors would be the students. We knew it had to be set on the school. And then in terms of filming, we really just had to pull kids out of classes here and there, so it was a really interesting film process, that's for sure. But the kids had a great time, and I think they learned a ton, and it came out really well.
I'm not sure they minded being pulled from class.
Oh no, they didn't. No.
What is it about shorts that each of you like? What attracts you to this part of the film medium, Matt?
It's fun to tell a story that you're not requiring too much of people to engage with. It's very easy to ask somebody to watch your short.
Does it force you to be more creative in your storytelling and filming?
I think so.
Yeah. Lori?
I think it's probably mostly driven by budget, since most of us have little or no budget. So doing a short is a great way to share a story. Every story has a beginning, middle, and end. How much is in between that, I guess, is the difference between a short and a feature-length film. But it's the budget and the time constraint of the people that are involved. So rather than not do something, this was an alternate way to do it. And nowadays with technology, it isn't too difficult to do it even with your phone, although we had a wonderful cameraman with Steve Tanzen and of course, the editing that Heidi also did. But, you know, you can everybody should be able to do a short.
Well, what do you think about that, being able to produce some pretty high-quality content on your phone? It's a democratization of filmmaking, but does it detract from the work at all? What do you think about that?
The more people that can create, and especially listening, you know, having kids start to create at a young age, I think can only be a good thing. Mm-hmm. So I think giving people access will result in higher quality creativity. And, you know, again, you're always going to have the blockbusters. But even now, you know, when you look at a blockbuster film, you know, you expect more. So maybe it's just raising the bar for all of us.
Kelly, did the kids get attracted to that? Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely do. I agree with both. You know, the short is a wonderful way to be able to introduce the kids to the art of screenwriting without expecting them, you know, to immediately produce an entire screenplay. But that said, I mean, they really blew away my expectations of what they would produce. You know, I said we had studied screenwriting. It was part of an elective, and it was four kids in the class. And, you know, they really got so into it. And the story is really amazing. I think people will be kind of surprised at the level of storytelling, given their limitations, what they pulled off. You know, and I think that then they're only going to get better from here, and it's going to be a great launching point for young people. So I totally agree with Lori. I like the democratization of, you know, giving more people access to tell good stories.
Now, you know, it's festival season. We've seen Venice, and we've got those famous film festivals, Toronto. Where does Big Eddie fit into that for you guys? Right after Venice, yeah. I'd say. I go like Venice 1, Big Eddie 2.
Yeah. We're aiming for Cannes next.
There you go.
Yeah.
But it's a special thing, right? It's kind of in your backyard.
Absolutely.
They didn't have Bethel Woods. I mean, what a venue. Exciting.
For me, I grew up living in Narrowsburg, and so for me, it's really exciting to be able to play my film there, especially because it was shot there. My last film premiered at Telluride and then played Big Eddie right afterward, and both of them were extremely enjoyable experiences.
And it's the 10th anniversary of the film festival. You know, it's the little film festival that could, I guess. What are your thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I hope that it keeps growing.
Lori?
So I remember when it started and supporting it from the beginning, and to see how it's grown. And honestly, I'm deeply honored and so excited to see it go to Bethel Woods, as much as I love the charm of having it at the Tustin, which is another charming theater. But being at Bethel Woods is really a statement on how much it's grown, how much Narrowsburg and Sullivan County has grown as an arts community. I also wanted to just add one more thing about what we were just talking about, the having access for people. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's the story. These films represent the power of communication, just like any art form. So it doesn't really matter. When you add all the bells and whistles, that's great. But if you can just tell your story with the basics and the least amount of extras possible, then you're really focusing on the story, and that's what's important, and that's where you're really learning how to communicate better.
Makes you focus on the task at hand.
Correct.
Kelly, any thoughts about the 10th anniversary of Big Eddie?
Yeah, I mean, we're really, really excited to be included, and I think one of the things that's wonderful about this is that, you know, having these kids involved, I hope it makes people think about the future of the films to come, you know, and it's 10th anniversary is such a great milestone. But I think these kids are going to be bringing films now. Like, now that they've seen this is a possibility, I have a feeling that we're going to be trying to submit films, you know, every year. And that's really exciting to me because it's a big milestone for them, and it's a jumping off point for us for the future.
Might keep them off of TikTok.
Yeah, who knows?
Well, we've been talking to Matt Sukar, Lori Guzda, and Kelly Adams. They are filmmakers who have their short films, among seven short films, in Rural Shorts, part of the Big Eddy Film Festival's 10th anniversary. These are local filmmakers and their work. It will be Saturday, October 2nd, 5:30 at Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. More information at BigEddyFilmFest.com. Matt, Lori, Kelly, thank you all for gathering and talking to us, and have a great Rural Shorts.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Soon, look forward to meeting you guys next Saturday, and hope to see everybody else come on down and enjoy it.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. What caused the feud between the Montagues and Capulets? Lady Capulet is a prequel to Romeo and Juliet that aims to find out, following the journey of Rose from country girl to matriarch, navigating her repression and power in the 16th century Verona, when family, social status, and gender determine everything. Farm Arts Collective presents a live performance of Lady Capulet by Melissa Bell tomorrow at 4 p.m., and we're welcoming a new member to our team, reporting intern Meg Duff. She spoke to the actress playing Lady Capulet, Janzi Colon Soto.
Part of the teaser for this show is the question, who started the feud, right? Romeo and Juliet is about this big feud between these two families. And it seems like this story might have an answer to that. Can you tell us, or is that telling?
Yes, the answer is that there is an answer. I won't tell you what exactly happened, but I will say that Rose / Lady Capulet is definitely in the middle of that answer. And even if she's not the only one who's at fault, because she's definitely not, she definitely had a hand in making that happen.
So, Janzi, you're the lead actress. You are Lady Capulet in this play. What can you tell us? Give us a taste of what this play is about.
So I would say that this is a play that really has a little bit of something for everybody. I mean, we start with Rose when she's a pretty young girl, you know, she's around 13 or 14, which is, you know, Juliet's age when we meet her in Romeo and Juliet. And we get to see her grow up and become the Lady of Verona that is Lady Capulet. So it really is sort of this hero's journey. We get to see her use everything in her arsenal to navigate this world of politics and wealth and family and honor. And she really has to pull out everything she's got, from like her feminine wiles to her raw intelligence and cunning, to sort of make sure that she can get through this world, because it's not easy.
You have also had the opportunity to play Sonia Sotomayor. And so you've been able to sort of be inside the head of these women who are navigating politics in really interesting different ways. And this is a show that's about that navigation. And so I'm curious, as you have been coming to these questions of family and money and gender and power, what have you been drawing on in your own life? And what of what you're seeing in Lady Capulet's journey still resonates today?
I think the most universal theme about Rose's journey is that, you know, even setting aside gender, but specifically for women and people who are not cis men, it can feel a lot of times like you are walking alone, like you have to sort of be up against these stakes and circumstances just by nature of how the world is framed around us. She basically takes it upon herself to craft this web of lies, essentially, in order to do what she thinks is best for her family. You know, she gets caught in a bad, bad situation that could ruin her family forever, really. And she takes it upon herself to say, okay, so I just got to do what I got to do. And I feel like that is just a relatable journey for anybody. You know, sometimes things happen in your life and you're like, this is my problem. I have to figure it out. I have to be responsible. And the exploration of Rose's journey is interesting because she's not a perfect person and she doesn't do things in the best way sometimes. And we get to see her make mistakes, but above all, we always know that she's trying. She's doing these things because she cares. And I feel like that's any of us, you know, I feel like any of us are just trying our best, especially coming out of this pandemic. We are all struggling. And that's what makes Rose relatable and lovable ultimately, even if, you know, she doesn't do things right all of the time.
This show originally premiered with Barefoot Shakespeare, with the Barefoot Shakespeare Company in Central Park. And you played in that version. How are you feeling about doing this at Farm Arts? And can you tell us a little bit about the Farm Arts venue?
I'm so excited to be doing this at Farm Arts for a lot of reasons. One, I think the farm location lends itself so well to a lot of the locations in the show. You know, Rose is from a town called Santonio, which is in the country. She talks about being from the country. So we sort of get to be in this place that feels like a modern version of what she would have had when she was growing up. So that is pretty cool in terms of getting us in character, so to speak, for the experience. But on top of that, I'm really excited because part of the playing space is this greenhouse that they have. And, you know, doing the show at Summit Rock was incredible. The Rock is an absolutely beautiful location. But I'm so excited to have a greenhouse because now we have like a backstage area so we can like go in there and change our costumes. It was definitely challenging and in the best ways doing the show at Summit Rock because the show is actually inherently an intimate show. I mean, you know, the relationships are intimate and there are scenes that require a literal intimacy director. Like it's that kind of show where, you know, it could be difficult. We weren't able to stage it to its full potential because of it being outdoors in the park, in a public place. So I'm excited that the farm is going to be a slightly more private space, even if it's outdoors. We do have the luxury of having that sort of like little backstage area. And it's just a huge, beautiful field where they do this. And they have musicians that are going to be playing the music for the show. It's going to lend itself so well.
This is a telling of the backstory of Romeo and Juliet. Is it Shakespearean English? Is it modern? What should people expect?
So it is Shakespeare-esque is what I would say. Pretty much what we get all across the board is folks who aren't super into Shakespeare, that don't know Shakespeare very well, were able to key into the story pretty quickly and understand it. Melissa does a really great job of having written it in a way that sounds Shakespearean without it being actual verse. And my mom is not a Shakespeare person at all, and she's going to come to the show, and I just know that she's going to love it. I would never have recommended it to her otherwise, because I just know that it's not really her thing. So I recommend it for anyone.
That's great. So if people are interested in coming out, where should they go?
So if you're interested in coming to see this show, we are going to be at the Farm Arts Collective in Damascus, Pennsylvania on Saturday and Sunday, September 25th and 26th at 4 p.m. And if you're looking for your tickets, you can go online to farmartscollective.org to check us out.
Thank you so much, Jansi.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
That was reporting intern Meg Duff. Thank you for that report. Good job. First one for us. And thank you for listening. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Come see us at the Honeybee Festival later this afternoon at 4 in Narrowsburg. Say hi to Rosie and Ken and myself. And have a great day.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, located in Harris and Calicoon. A member of the Garnet Health System, garnethealth.org. The River Reporter Newspaper in Narrowsburg, riverreporter.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.